just about every week, we talk about what we're watching or reading or listening to right now. Today, we're doing something different. We're going back 20 years to talk about some of the movies of 1999.
We will talk about what holds up, what looks really different, and what we miss the most. I'm Stephen Thompson.
And I'm Linda Holmes. We're doing a movie time capsule on today's Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR, so don't go away.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Kroger. Did you know 1 in 8 Americans struggle with hunger? Yet 40% of the food produced in the U.S. gets thrown away. Kroger believes that if just 1/3 of that wasted food could be redirected to people in need, it would more than cover unmet food needs across the country while helping to protect our planet. That's what Kroger is doing through their Zero Hunger, Zero Waste Foundation. Last year alone, Kroger donated 325 million meals to local food banks. It's part of their goal to achieve zero hunger and zero waste by 2025. Learn more at kroger.com/ZHZW.
Welcome back. You just met NPR Music's Stephen Thompson. Also with us is Glenn Weldon of the NPR Arts Desk. Hi, Glenn.
Hey, Linda.
And I want to talk a little bit about how we got this idea. We were talking about anniversaries, and we were trying to think what's a good time to kind of take a look back at some films, not necessarily the best movies of 1999 or even our favorite movies of 1999, but some of the ones that we just thought it would be most interesting to look at how they had aged. And Stephen, you jotted down just some of the movies that came out in this very big year. Why don't you hit me with part of that list?
Yeah, I mean, think about this as 1 year of cinematic releases. And these are just the movies that really penetrated the popular consciousness. The Matrix, Fight Club, Being John Malkovich, Blair Witch Project, Sixth Sense, Magnolia, The Iron Giant, Toy Story 2, American Pie, 10 Things I Hate About You, Notting Hill, Cruel Intentions, a lot of these teen movies, Varsity Blues, She's All That, The Best Man, it goes on and on. Runaway Bride, Star Wars Episode 1.
Yeah. And Glenn, you were pointing out that we remembered, sort of after we had come up with this idea, we remembered there's a book about 1999 movies.
There's a brand new book called Best Movie Year Ever by Brian Rafferty. I have not read it myself, but we are not alone in noting that this was an incredible year for film.
So we thought that we would take a look back, and we each picked a film. And Glenn, I'm going to start with you. What did you pick?
Once a carny, always a carny. I picked Drop Dead Gorgeous.
All right, explain what Drop Dead Gorgeous is.
Drop Dead Gorgeous is a chance to see all your favorite actresses of today in a kind of fetal mode. tiny Amy Adams, and of course...
She was in that.
Yeah, she is, and she's great. It's a small part. It's amazing to see. And of course, Kirsten Dunst. She is fantastic in this. She's charming. The story is about a Minnesota beauty pageant. There's a lot of sweaty Minnesota accents, but Kirstie Alley is in this, and she is playing full-out villain, and she's having a ball, but that's not all. It's Allison Janney. It's Denise Richards. It's Ellen Barkin doing what Ellen Barkin does best, and Allison Janney is playing a kind of version of the character she'd go on to play in I, Tonya. It's like she's kinder than she is here, but it's just so good. I did not have a very strong relationship with this film when it came out, but it is Faustino's favorite film of all time.
Your husband.
Yes. So through him, I got a chance to watch it again last night. Hadn't seen it since it came out. It didn't become a cult hit for me, but it has become a cult hit to a great many people.
Yeah. What do you think it is about it?
I think it's just that it's these women, I think. This is a film that doesn't have a lot of time for dudes, and you don't miss them because they're just having so much fun. And there's actually a real, I forgot about it. I just thought it was satire all the way through. It largely is, but there is a real story here delivered on the back of Kirsten Dunst's performance. She is real. She is incredibly charismatic, and she just, invites you in.
And can you tell us a little bit more about what actually happens in the movie?
Sure. There is this Minnesota beauty pageant, and several of the competitors, especially the ones who are threatening Kirstie Alley's daughter for the title, mysteriously die in a variety of ways. There is a lot of making fun of the heartland, but it doesn't come off as mean or gratuitous. It comes off as, again, because of Kirsten Dunst's performance, there's a real heart there.
What do you think would feel different about it if it came out right now?
Yeah, it's broad and campy, and we might rein that in a little bit now, maybe. And there are, of course, some, the evil characters say a bunch of slurs because they're evil, right? I don't think we would let We get away with that quite as easily today.
Yeah.
But I also think that we would not see a lineup of this kind of murderer's row of actresses without it becoming a huge thing. It's
yeah.
like, because this is catching all these people at not at their height, but right before they're about to hit. It's fantastic.
Yeah, I feel like it's the kind of thing that might be a Netflix series if it came out now, you know?
Absolutely.
Like a little more built out with all these different stories sprawling all over the place. I wonder if it's the kind of story that would have gone in that direction if we had had that format. All right, Drop Dead Gorgeous is Glenn's pick. Holds up. Stephen Thompson, what's your pick?
Well, my pick is Office Space, a Mike Judge workplace comedy, kind of workplace satire. Clearly a very, very influential film. It's Ron Livingston as an office drone who is unhappy at his job. And you mentioned the plot. That's pretty much the plot.
Yep.
Yeah.
It has him kind of working through. He's got a terrible boss played by Gary Cole, who is very funny. It's got a little bit of a parade of grotesques among his various coworkers, and it's launched a ton of memes and bits and things that have just kind of been etched into the cultural firmament, mm-hmm. from the red stapler to the TPS report to the PC load letter. You know, lots of little
flair.
You mentioned the flair. I was frustrated by the Jennifer Aniston part. You know, she is Ron Livingston's love interest. She is also unhappy at her job, but all it really gives her to be unhappy about is that she's expected to put all this, as you say, flair on her uniform, and that's kind of this thing.
Buttons and things.
And that's kind of all it keeps coming back to instead of talking about other things that might be unpleasant about being a TGI Friday style waitress.
And you would think there is probably an entire comedy to be written about being a TGI Friday's style waitress.
Exactly.
That isn't just about buttons, although I remember thinking the buttons were kind of funny.
The buttons were funny, and apparently TGI Fridays actually stopped making its wait staff wear that stuff because they had so many comments because of Office Space. And part of what's interesting about this movie is that it flopped. Because of cable, because of DVD sales at the time, later because of streaming, ended up becoming this movie that pretty much everyone has seen, that everyone can reference, even though it was not a major cultural moment when it came out. And I do think when we talk about what is different in 2019 versus 1999, I mean, Linda, you said Netflix series about Drop Dead Gorgeous. This feels very much like television. This movie really works as television, and not just because we've also had many, many seasons of The Office mining some of the similar material, but because this is a very small, very contained movie, there's no reason you would have had to see this movie in the theater.
Right.
And so I think this movie's smallness hurt it upon its release and has helped it in the 20 years since.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about the way it compares to The Office as a sort of comedy about office drones?
The Office as a series has so many opportunities to develop all these sub characters. So Phyllis on The Office ends up having layers and nuances, and Stanley ends up having layers and nuances. You know, all these characters who would, in this movie, get to have lots of traits on a sitcom.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, and so the thinness of a lot of these portrayals are in part because this is an 89-minute movie instead of a TV show that really lets you get a feeling for who all these people are. This movie isn't necessarily going super deep. It's not really going very far beyond, like, these office parks are gray, literally and figuratively gray, miserable places.
Right.
And I still enjoyed it. I laughed out loud on numerous occasions. There, you know, there are elements of it that don't age as well, but it is somewhat thin. It's a little thinner than it needed to be. And at 89 minutes, Mike Judge is so talented and somebody I really, really enjoy. As a movie director, he doesn't necessarily have a great feel for pacing.
Yeah.
And so those 89 minutes actually drag a little bit, and I felt like it could have been tightened up to make room for a little bit richer characterization.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. The main character, Ron Livingston's performance, you can overlook it almost because it is so passive. It is so kind of gray because he's been beaten down. So to fill that vacuum, and he does a great job because he's pretty much a cipher, and yet we still feel for him.
Yeah.
But to fill that vacuum, you have these really deep swing for the fences character performances from Stephen Root.
Stephen Root is very funny.
Gary Cole's boss is a very specific kind of terrible boss
yeah.
that I hadn't seen on screen before. Mm-hmm. And when you see it now, you go, that's he's doing Cary Cole. That's yeah. a Cary Cole thing. Mm-hmm. So you have a lot of specificity, which, you know, does equate to its caricature almost, the over the top to kind of fill that void.
Yeah. And that Stephen Root performance, what I always think is funny about the Stephen Root performance, and he plays a very, very weird guy who's very possessive about his items and his cube and all that stuff. I think it's so funny to contrast that a lot of people have seen him primarily in that and as Jimmy James on News Radio,
yeah.
because those are such diametrically opposed performances. One is this sort of all-powerful, rich guy, and one is this kind of really—
The least powerful possible person.
I think that's such a funny performance to look at, and it really just in those two performances gives you a sense of how really versatile he is. And he really is that guy who kind of can do almost anything.
He is somebody who is basically always funny.
Yeah. Anyway, thank you very much. Stephen Thompson's pick is Office Space. My pick is The Talented Mr. Ripley,
yeah.
directed by Anthony Minghella. And it's based on the Patricia Highsmith novel, but it changes a little bit, partly because she went on to write several novels about Tom Ripley, whereas this is a very closed film. Fortunately, they did not give in to the urge to make a franchise of Mr. Ripley movies, because I definitely don't think you needed them. This is Matt Damon 2 years after Good Will Hunting. So it's after Good Will Hunting, after Rounders, but before really he became more of a classic kind of lead actor, before the Bourne movies, before mm-hmm. all. He's very skinny in this movie. And he's playing a guy named Tom Ripley. And Tom Ripley is he's not a desperately poor guy, but he's a just kind of regular guy who winds up being kind of mistaken for it takes place in the 1950s, and being mistaken for a person of sort of higher status than he is. And he winds up meeting and becoming enmeshed with this character named Dickie Greenleaf, played by Jude Law at his most beautiful.
Yep.
And he becomes kind of obsessed with Dickie. He becomes obsessed with Dickie's identity. He eventually begins to pretend to be Dickie at different times in different places. Cast includes not just Matt Damon in sort of my favorite incarnation of Matt Damon and Jude Law in the most beautiful, and also, it should be said, very, very good and Oscar-nominated
yes.
Jude Law, but also Gwyneth Paltrow, Kate Blanchett, Philip Seymour Hoffman, mm-hmm. who comes in as kind of a savvy mm-hmm. guy who still does not understand what he's getting into in tangling with
yep.
Tom Ripley, who's one of the things I liked about this movie when I rewatched it. Is that, first of all, it's a really beautiful, sumptuous, you know, most of it takes place in Italy. It's very, you know, you get a lot of the kind of 1950s Italian countryside and little jazz clubs. And
what chocolat is for chocolate, this movie is for faces.
Yeah.
It's a great point. And everyone in it looks, you know, looks amazing. And that's on purpose. It's made to be this beautiful portrait of this extraordinarily twisted young man. And what I liked about it on rewatch is that it really doesn't concern itself a whole lot with backstory for mm-hmm. Tom Ripley. It takes him as he is, right? And you know that he is a troubled and lonely person. That is why he becomes obsessed with Dickie and wants to attach himself to Dickie. But they don't really spend a lot of time specifying, you know, this is how Tom got to be like this, because that's always what I don't care about as much. There are just so many great scenes in this film between really good, at the time, young actors. The last scene that Philip Seymour Hoffman and Matt Damon have together in this film is this really kind of mostly unspoken. Some things are being said, other things not. As I said, Philip Seymour Hoffman, on the one hand, is the very savvy guy who's sort of on to Tom Ripley, but at the same time does not understand what he is dealing with. The film is so shot through with homoeroticism mm-hmm. between Tom and Dickie. And you can tell, I think when you watch it, you get the feeling that Dickie is... he's somewhat manipulating Tom on purpose, in the sense that he knows at some level that Tom is in love with him. But he would never admit that that's what he's doing. Mm-hmm. But is he flirting back? Is he kind of, you know, is he showing himself naked to Tom on purpose? It's all just part of Dickie's thing that he's doing. And so I think the film understands how manipulative he is, but also really appreciates the wonderful life that these people are living. And I think encourages you to understand what it is about all this that appeals to Tom so much. And mm-hmm. not all the people are terrible, particularly the two women, the character Meredith, who is played by Cate Blanchett, a quite young and also sparkly and wonderful looking Cate Blanchett, and Gwyneth Paltrow's character. Those are both basically decent, nice young women who are sort of caught up in all of this stuff. Mm-hmm. It's my favorite incarnation of several of these people. It's my favorite, maybe other than Emma, my favorite Gwyneth Paltrow sort of incarnation. It's my favorite Matt Damon. It's my favorite Jude Law. Every Philip Seymour Hoffman is my favorite Philip Seymour Hoffman. And they're all, you know, even the private detective who comes in at the end and is not in it for very long is played by Philip Baker Hall.
Sure,
like, kind of everyone in this movie is amazing.
Yeah.
I really loved rewatching it. It's a gorgeous movie. I think they would deal with the fact that Tom is gay a little bit differently probably now. Mm-hmm. The point is it's the 50s and it is tamped down, but I don't know if that might look different.
And it is Patricia Highsmith who does homoeroticism, crime, charismatic people. Mm-hmm. That's kind of her wheelhouse. I just want to go back and talk a little bit more about The Matrix, which was a phenomenon. I can remember I was temping at the Washington Post, and one weekend, everybody came back in that Monday and just started acting this film mm-hmm. out. It was not just dudes. It was everybody who was just, they hadn't seen anything like this before.
Yeah, one thing that's really striking is the number of films from 1999 that were phenomena. Mm-hmm. Not only The Matrix, but movies like Fight Club, Blair Witch Project, American Pie, movies that penetrated the public consciousness to the point where they had catchphrases attached to them.
Right.
You talk about The Matrix with the red pill. No, the rule of Fight Club is no one talks about Fight Club. American Pie, and you know that time at band camp. I mean, there's so many of these movies that people still refer to today because they had so firmly penetrated the public consciousness.
Good stuff. I am excited to talk about this stuff, and we want to hear about your favorite movies from 1999. Come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH and on Twitter at PCHH. That brings us to the end of our show. Thanks to you guys for being here and talking to me.
Thank you.
And of course, thank you for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. If you have a second, please subscribe to our newsletter. You can do that at npr.org/popculturenewsletter. And we will see you all right back here on Friday when we will be discussing It, Chapter 2.
Starting college can be overwhelming.
Everyone from almost every background has that fear that they got in here by accident. That's scary.
NPR's Life Kit is here to help make your freshman year a little easier. Listen to NPR Life Kit's new guide on college, or subscribe to Life Kit All Guides for all the episodes all in one place.